This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. And we are at the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College after Elizabeth Warren gives a speech today focused on her economic policy. And we'll get to that in just a bit. But first, we should note that we are now less than 2 months away from voting in the First Nation presidential primary set for February the 11th. And I think we're going to kind of set the scene to start today's show. We'll have interviews coming up in just a little bit. Jill Biden was in the Granite State, and she talks about Joe kind of behind the scenes off the trail in that conversation. And also, Deval Patrick was in Concord, and he joined me for a conversation over the phone. And Michael Bennett sat down inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street Studios. He has focused on New Hampshire and is going to be in New Hampshire a lot leading up to the First Nation presidential primaries. We welcome in Paul Steinhauser now here at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. We're looking around and seeing some memorabilia and decor from primaries past, President Eisenhower's New Hampshire trip, including his arrival in Concord. And it's a pretty special place, New Hampshire Institute of Politics. There's not really a museum per se in New Hampshire yet in regards to the primary, but this is as close as you're going to get to it. So a good backdrop, if you will, for today's show.
It really is, and this has kind of been the mecca for the last two decades now. It's a must-stop for candidates, and it really is. If you want the history of the primary, you come here to catch a glimpse of it. Elizabeth Warren here today, and this is interesting because she will not be doing politics and eggs. I would highly doubt that. That is the business crowd and slightly academic crowd. It's a speaking series. It has become a must-stop for presidential candidates over the last two dozen years, I'd say. But she won't be coming for that. She's here to give a speech separate of that. That's more of a business crowd where she probably wouldn't be so comfortable. I doubt Bernie Sanders would be doing that either. But she'll be making a big economic speech here about how corruption has really hurt the average person when it comes to economic opportunities.
And she's looking to reset her campaign. And she needs something to change the trajectory of that, because that trajectory, particularly in Iowa and New Hampshire, states that she has to do really, really well in, if not win one of them. She is moving in a downwards direction. So let's kind of set the scene as to where things are at right now. As I've talked about before, this is Bernie Sanders' primary to lose until he does it, based upon his success in the past campaign, based upon his base of support, which is, I think, the strongest out of any of the candidates. And polling indicates that Bernie Sanders, again, there's four candidates that could win the New Hampshire primary. But in my view, out of those four, he is the favorite at this point to win.
Maybe. Chris. He's definitely part of that top tier, no doubt about that. That top tier includes him. It includes the former Vice President Joe Biden, and it includes Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor. It did include Elizabeth Warren until recent polling.
So you think she's not a part of that group anymore? Not there yet.
She's slipping. She is slipping. You look at her average now, and it's down in the lower double digits, you know, anywhere from about 12 to 15%. So she's starting to have some deterioration, which is not good. And it's come since October, really, since she got scrutinized more and more over her Medicare for All plan and then and how she would pay for it and how long the timetable would be for her implementation. And she's faced a lot of questions that she hadn't faced before.
The challenge with where Elizabeth Warren is right now as she looks to reboot is that she has spent this entire campaign so far going after individuals who are pragmatic about policy and saying, oh, you need to build consensus or work with the other side. And she said, no, we need big, bold change, and we're going to make that happen. I'm going to bring forth these plans, and I'm going to fight to get it done. And now on Medicare for All, she's saying, well, we have to be kind of pragmatic about that. And so she has angered the individuals in the center who want pragmatism and both sides to work together with the rhetoric she's used so far in this campaign. And now she's angered progressives because she is not fighting for the boldest possible way to implement Medicare for All. So that is where she is at right now, and pushing forth a campaign where it's, okay, I am the progressive that can get things done. Pete Buttigieg has kind of filled that space so far. Mm-hmm. And B, she has already said that she doesn't believe in pragmatism, basically.
Yeah. So she's walking this fine line because she doesn't want to upset those progressive voters that are the key to her base. She's battling Bernie Sanders for those voters. But at the same time, she's also trying to appeal to more highly educated, upscale white voters, battling Pete Buttigieg and to a degree Joe Biden for those votes. So you're trying to be everything to everybody. That's not easy.
Yeah, and I think that that's a big challenge for her moving forward. So the question with Warren is, now that she's starting to drop a little bit, where over the summer you looked at the odds out of Vegas, you talked to folks, and they thought Elizabeth Warren was probably the favorite to win the nomination. I thought that was a little bit hasty, and the numbers are still and have always been there for Joe Biden still to win the nomination. But she was an individual that people were talking about. And she could still very easily come back and have success because she's a very good speaker. She's very convincing and passionate and has been really adept at working one-on-one with voters. So the question now is, now that she's on the ropes and is struggling here going into this December debate, is this the time where, you know, an Amy Klobuchar, who is looking to surpass her in Iowa to keep her chances at the nomination alive and has sparred with Warren to some degree so far in the debates, I mean, is this the time where Pete Buttigieg, who has been assailed by Warren, where they go for the knockout?
Yeah, I think you're going to see an aggressive Buttigieg and an aggressive Klobuchar, just like we saw in October, two debates ago, go after Warren. Why not? She's wounded now. And especially as we sit here and record this show, we had a major study from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton Business School there, coming out just a few hours ago saying that, guess what, the math for her wealth tax, which would pay for basically everything she's proposing, doesn't add up. It's far short of the projections she thought that would come in. Now, her campaign is pushing back on that, but that would be a big blow as well to her because the wealth tax is popular with her voters. It gets a big cheer every time at every one of her events. Warren's changing things. We've noticed this. I wrote about this for Fox News. Shorter stump speeches, more questions. She's even moderated a little bit more on Medicare for All, on the implementation. And she's gotten a lot feistier going after Buttigieg, something she would have never done months ago. She realizes she needs to change something. But to your question, yes, now is the time to try to sink her if you're a rival.
And that's the other point as well, where she spent months talking about the fact that she wasn't going to go after opponents.
And
that
by
she,
name, yeah.
Yeah, and then she did, and she went after him in a significant way. Now, the McKinsey stuff is almost laughable. I was watching Buttigieg on Rachel Maddow, and she's like pressing him hard on his work with Blue Cross Blue Shield. And he answers the question for about a minute and 30 seconds, and then he says, you know, but the job was a little bit more about learning how to do a PowerPoint presentation and a spreadsheet, because he had an entry-level position at McKinsey. So that stuff I don't think resonates. But the fundraisers and what promises he's making to, and she's tying, you know, this speech into that and saying, you know, that individual like Buttigieg or Biden that draw from these large donors and bundlers are going to owe these people something, and that's a part of the problem with you know, the corruption that exists within our politics. And that, I think, can resonate.
Yeah, though I'm not going to give them a free pass on McKinsey because, you know, healthcare and Medicare for All is such a key part of this race. It's top vote. So
that's a key point in that people who don't pay attention to the details of that and realize that he had an entry-level position will say, oh, this firm is like Bain, and they've made the Romney comparison. So you can play politics.
There were cuts in Michigan. People lost their coverage. People lost their jobs with Blue Cross Blue Shield. Not because of Buttigieg, but it did happen, and I can see how other campaigns will tie the two together. Now, Buttigieg's argument is this, as you just said, well, it was entry level. Well, that could backfire, too, because that just shows how young and inexperienced
he is
compared to these other people.
That jumped out at me, too.
Yeah, like, wait a minute.
It's like, oh, okay, so his work at McKinsey, which has been, you know, discussed a lot, where he was basically had no say or authority of any sort, and was just basically learning his way in the business world. So you're right. I mean, that highlights the inexperience side of things as well. But again, like it was laughable when he was talking about Maddow's pushing him as if he was able to change these policies and he was responsible for it. And he's like, no, basically, I was learning how to do a PowerPoint. So Buttigieg still has a ton of upwards mobility. But let's bring it back to Joe Biden. And, you know, Biden has been criticized and has been, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about his performance. I still think that his inability to really address the Hunter Biden situation in a way where there's still not that gray area out there, like we talked about with McKinsey, where political opponents and the right are able to say he hasn't cleaned it up sufficiently, whether that's right or wrong. I think that that's still a political liability for him. But you look at the numbers for Biden, he's really strong in Nevada. He is incredibly strong in South Carolina, and he's at or near the top in Iowa and New Hampshire. So the potential exists for Joe Biden, perhaps more than any other candidate, to wrap up this contest very quickly if he is able to have success, be in the top one or two or close third in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's the wild thing about it right now. We really don't know what could happen because that is one scenario. He does well, like you said, in Iowa and New Hampshire, and then Nevada and South Carolina, his states. He comes, it's like John Kerry in 2004. Mm-hmm. Boom, 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 victory, victory, victory. That primary was over quickly.
And no one thought it would be.
Nobody thought it would be. Could be the same here. The flip side is if he stumbles in Iowa and in New Hampshire, then it could be wide open. And
that potential exists too.
Yeah, very, very easy to happen. And then that could mean no candidate comes out of the early voting states with momentum, which could then help a Michael Bloomberg. So who the heck knows, right?
And that's the great thing about this process is that we can debate and go through the day in, day out of it and say, oh, this is the direction that things are trending in. This is the way that it looks. But the fact of the matter is that this is a fluid contest. I'm not there on Elizabeth Warren being outside of that top four as of yet. I think we need to see the debate and see how things go over the next few weeks. She's on the brink of falling out of the top four. But I still think there's four individuals that could win the nomination. And that's rare in these types of contests. Well, we're going to get into things up next. Individual who has the chance to be the next First Lady of the United States. Jill Biden joins us up next. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Today, coming to you from the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show. I'm joined on the program right now by Dr. Jill Biden, of course, the wife of former Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Dr. Biden, how are you?
I'm great this morning. How are you doing?
Great. I want to start off with this. Your husband is one of the most famous people in the world, and everybody has their clear idea as to who he is. But I'm curious from your perspective as to who he is, in particular, the individual that maybe is not seen in the public eye.
I don't know. People have seen my husband now for many years, and I think he's not different, at home than he is when you see him out on the road. I mean, he's gregarious. He's friendly. People are drawn to him. And I think that warmth comes through to people, and wherever we go, a lot people just flock to him. So he's really not different. He has he's very energetic. He's if you've seen him in a crowd, he likes to make sure he talks to everybody and shakes their hand. He does a great selfie. He's really learned how to take those quickly, and so really he's no different than what you see when you see him in a crowd.
One of the narratives about the vice president during the course of this campaign has been that he perhaps does not have what he used to have, and he's pushed back on that hard. But it still exists amongst voters, and I'm curious as to when you hear that, what you think, what comes to mind, and how you deal with it.
Well, I really don't see that, because of course I'm around Joe a lot at home, and I'm telling you, he never stops, and he's always going 100 miles an hour from the minute he wakes up. He's he's taking the dogs out to run, or he's bringing wood in for the fire, or sometimes I have to say to him in the morning, Joe, please just wait till I have my coffee until you start, because he wakes up with all these ideas in his head and things he wants to tell me. So I don't see that. He's as energetic as he ever was.
In terms of your role in his life in regards to
public policy. Are you an individual that he comes to a lot and will bounce ideas off of in regards to policy, given the fact that you two are an intellectual and you have that skill set that you can help him with? Do you see yourself? Do you see that taking place on a continuous basis, or is the, you know, whether when he was vice president or when he's thinking about policies for the presidential campaign, that you separate the home life from the public life?
Well, I'm a teacher, so I've been a teacher for 35 years. So Joe has heard me talk about the classroom, education policies, what teachers need. I've been traveling all over this country talking to teachers. And so I hope that some of what I've said to Joe has been put into his education policy, because that's really important to me as a teacher. And I wanted to make sure that, it was teacher-centered, that teachers had made the decisions, that they weren't told what to do from a Secretary of Education, that they would be the ones making the policy. But, look, Chris, I mean, it's a marriage. We lean on each other. He supports me. All our years of marriage, I went to school to get advanced degrees, and he'd pick up the slack, and now he's running for president, and sometimes I pick up the slack. I mean, that's what a loving relationship is based on, isn't it? That we support each other and help each other out.
How much has this campaign weighed on you as a family, in particular as as President Trump has made Hunter Biden pretty much one of the centerpieces of the public discourse at this point, and the fact that impeachment to a large degree is focused on the president wanting to find out information about Hunter and Joe? Has that weighed on and you and the vice president a lot, or do you see it as essentially a part of the process?
Well, we know who Donald Trump is, and this has been a distraction. Donald Trump wants to make it a distraction from the truth. He doesn't want to run against my husband. But, as a mother, it bothers me that, my son is being attacked. And, I feel very protective toward my son. And so we knew this going in. We knew it would be rough. We knew he would try any tactic that Trump would try any tactic, that he could come up with. And he has. And I'm sure he's going to continue, because that's the kind of man that Donald Trump is.
In conclusion, was it a difficult decision because of the times that we live in, or did you feel like that you kind of had to do this, given the times that we lived in, that you're willing to sacrifice perhaps some sanity, if you will, to do this and to make this sacrifice?
Chris, I don't think I would couch it as a sacrifice. I mean, really, when we were vice president, it was an honor to serve our country. And when we saw, especially Joe, Charlottesville and what happened there, and the president said, there are good people on both sides. Joe just said, this is not who we are as Americans. And he said, I have to get in this race. And that's when we went to our family and said, hey, guys, this is going to be tough, but, what do you think? And they said, oh, Pop has to do this. Dad has to do this. So I think the way that foreign countries look at us, I think what I'm hearing from my fellow Americans is that this is not who we are. We are an inclusive nation for all Americans. And I think we made the right choice by running.
Dr. Biden, appreciate your time. Look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks, Chris. Have a good holiday.
You as well. That is Jill Biden. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Former governor of Massachusetts Deval Patrick is next.
This
is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. I appreciate you joining us for the show as we welcome right now the former governor of Massachusetts, a late entrant into the Democratic presidential race, Deval Patrick, and for the show. And obviously the clock is ticking. You're getting a team assembled and to getting things off the ground.
We're looking forward to, you know, not just me making my pitch, but really engaging with people, hearing whether the policy choices that are on my mind as important are, in fact, the ones that folks are thinking about and worrying about. Because for me, you know, policy doesn't have that much abstract interest. It's just, it matters to me where it touches people. And as we think about how we solve problems, I want to make sure I'm listening to people as closely as possible.
No, I think you're 100% right. I mean, a lot of campaigning for president is hearing what is affecting individuals and making the determinations about what policies are important based upon that and what you're hearing consistently from voters. How does your campaign catch fire in your view? Because it does need to catch fire here in order to catch up to the front runners. There's certainly, as is always the case with the New Hampshire primary, a lot of unsettling at this point. Undecided voters and low information voters who are going to come into the fray here really in January and as we get closer to voting. So how do you kind of plant your flag and make an impact early on for those individuals?
Well, I think you're exactly right. In some respects, voters are just starting to pay attention to the upcoming New Hampshire primary. And so in that respect, I think we come in just on time. And the organization is building out quickly. But I think we catch fire by making it clear that the campaign's not about me, it's about us. That it belongs to the voters just as their government should belong to them. And if they make it personal, if they come and ask questions and engage and decide that this is a cause that they care about, and that cause being not just replacing the incumbent, but how do we build a prosperous and just America for everyone everywhere, not just the folks who are always involved in campaigns, but or not just the folks, frankly, who are involved in Democratic politics, but people who feel left out and left back. And they exist in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, and in every corner of the country.
John Kerry, former Secretary of State and U.S. Senator from the state of Massachusetts, endorsed Joe Biden yesterday. And I'm curious as your takeaways from that. And at this point in time, given the mood of the electorate, we saw Kamala Harris leave the race. We've seen a number of governors and U.S. senators and members of Congress who've had very successful careers kind of thrown to the wayside in this campaign. Is it a good thing still to have endorsements like that of a John Kerry? Or do you want to run a campaign that is outside of the traditional type of realm?
Well, listen, I welcome endorsements, especially from elected officials who are going to, you know, join us and in doing the work. Respect for John Kerry, I so appreciate him and the partnership that we had when he was in public office, and I at the same time. But I think that the most important endorsement, to say the obvious, Chris, is from the voter, the individual voter. The mighty as well as the meek, because I think that's how you not just win, but you make clear to anybody who's watching that folks understand that the campaign's about them and their future and the generational responsibility that we all have to leave things better for those who come behind us. The other thing I would say is that the field is broad and very talented. And there does seem to be a consensus, not just among the candidates, but among the electorate, that it is that the time is right to make big changes. I would say that there one distinction between me and many of the other candidates is that I've actually done the big changes that others talk about. We expanded health care to 98%+ of the residents in Massachusetts. We have a national model to respond to climate change, and at the same time create a clean tech economy that is prospering and growing. We changed big systems like the ethics system and the pension system, a transportation system. We've invested in infrastructure so that we start to create that platform for growth in the future, but also jobs right now. So some of the things that folks are talking about are things that I've actually done, and I understand that in order to get them done, you have to build bridges. That's how you get change that lasts, and that's also how you unite the country, which I think we're all hungry for today.
The upcoming debate in 2 weeks, there's a strong likelihood that there will be no minority candidates on stage for that particular debate. And there's been a lot of discussion about what should take place and whether there should be a change in the criteria in order to create a more diverse stage. And I'm curious as to what your takeaways are and on a broad number of topics in regards to that. Like, should there be an expansion in order to include, you know, African-American or minority candidates on to that stage? And B, is there a reason or rationale in your view that African-American voters are flocking to, you know, Joe Biden, it would appear, in South Carolina, and it also Bernie Sanders is doing well?
Well, first of all, I would say I'm not sure the polls are descriptive. When I'm out there, I'm seeing a lot of evidence that the polls are about name recognition and not necessarily commitment. And they would be at this point in the race, don't you think, Chris?
I agree.
We're not right at the point where people are deciding for whom they're going to vote. It has been a thrill for me as a citizen to see that the Democratic field is as diverse as it is from both a racial, ethnic, and a gender point of view. So much talent that makes me proud, and it's been personally thrilling to have friends who are African American and Latino and women who are in the field. The rules for becoming, the qualifying for being on the debate stage all change in January anyway, as I understand it. What they change to, we will see.
Right.
And I hope that as they change, we don't just talk about who qualifies, but how to change the format so that it really is a way to inform people about what our positions are. Because I don't think that is quite working just yet.
In conclusion, I mean, that's pretty, you know, crazy, the fact that it's, you know, December the 6th and January is coming around and campaigns don't know what the criteria is for the debates in January. I want to touch upon the issue of race and the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses. This has come up a little bit more consistently as of late. The fact there's a lack of diversity in New Hampshire and Iowa, what New Hampshire and Iowa's role should be moving forward. And the thing that jumps out at me the most is individuals pushing forth the notion that African-American or Hispanic or Asian candidates will not get a fair shake in a state like New Hampshire or Iowa, and that there's a natural disadvantage. And I'm curious as to what your feelings are on that.
Look, the African-American population in Massachusetts is not what would have made obvious the viability of my own candidacy for governor, meaning, you know, it's a relatively small proportion of the population. I don't think any of us is running. Maybe I'll speak for myself. I'm not running to be president of any one group. I'm not running to be president of the Democrats. I'm running to be president of everybody, everywhere. And that means I think we've got to go out and make our case to everyone, everywhere. It is true that the Democratic Party is a much more diverse party than the Democratic voters as a group are presumed to be more diverse and historically have been than the Republican Party. But I think there's an opportunity today to bring more people in to the party. And frankly, as we, at least in this campaign, redefine patriotism itself, because it's been this notion that we are that we are divided, and that we have been so easily divided, that is part of the reason we aren't doing what we need to do as patriots to make our country better and safer and more prosperous for all. I think there are ways to do that, and that's the way I have run campaigns in the past in Massachusetts, but Chris, it's how I've lived my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the argument, I really do. But you know, you don't want to presume that any one place is all defined by one thing, one set of people, one set of views, one set of predispositions. We've got to go and make our case to everybody, and part of the case I am making is that everyone, everywhere counts.
Governor Patrick, appreciate your time. Look forward to talking again soon.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
That is Deval Patrick. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Michael Bennett is next. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, Democratic presidential candidate, joins us inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. Senator Bennett, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for I feel like I'm at home. The snow's falling. It's beautiful.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's, and we really appreciate you joining us here. And let's just start off with an upshot as to how you see the campaign at this point in time. And certainly you're betting on New Hampshire, but this is obviously going to be a difficult task for you to get towards even winning in New Hampshire. No.
It's going to be tough for anybody, I think. But every time I see you, I feel like the race is less consolidated than it was the last time we talked. And so my theory of the case is that at some point when people in New Hampshire decide whom they're going to vote for, that what they're going to want to decide is that they want to nominate somebody that can actually beat Donald Trump. And I think that I'm in a much better position to do that than a lot of other people in this race, partly generationally, partly ideologically, partly because, you know, I've got a set of experiences that's different from anybody else. I mean, Mayor Pete was saying the other day that he was the right guy because his experience is at the local level. I ran a school district that was three times the size of the budget of the town that he ran in Indiana, but I've had 10 years in the Senate since then, business experience before that, and the knowledge of how to actually win, not just Democrats, but independents and a few Republicans as well.
So let's get into the policy side of things and talk a little about issues affecting the middle class. And you know, to me, a lot of individuals in the middle class have become complacent with a new norm and a life of okay, a life that may not be as good as their parents, but a life where they're just going to try to get by. But it seems that it's becoming more and more difficult for parents, particularly parents with young children, to deal with all the costs as they rise around them. How would you go about combating some of the main issues that are affecting the middle class from rising and is creating an environment where many are living paycheck to paycheck, some even using social services?
It is. You are absolutely right. If I had to summarize 10 years of vigorous town halls across my state, what people say is we're working really hard, but we can't afford some combination of housing, healthcare, higher education, early childhood education. If they're the families that I used to work for as superintendent of the Denver Public Schools, where most of the kids are kids of color, most of the kids are kids living in poverty, they say no matter how hard we work, we can't get our kids out of poverty. And what that means is that people can't live a middle class life or have an expectation that their kids are going to have a middle class life. They can't save, and they feel like their kids are going to live a more diminished life than their parents lived. I mean, when I was graduating from college in the late 80s, that would have been unimaginable to Americans. And today, I think you're right. I mean, people are not happy about it, but because we're Americans, we'll bear up under it. And this should be the focus of this election. It should be the focus of the Democratic Party. It's the reason Donald Trump got elected. He said he was going to solve this problem. He's done nothing really except make matters worse, taking health care away from people and cutting taxes for rich people. My view is we should reverse the Trump tax cuts, give a massive increase to the child tax credit that would cut childhood poverty in this country by 40% and be a real tax cut for the middle class, increase the earned income tax credit, create paid family leave in this country, and raise the minimum wage. I think if you take those things together, that would be a real boost for working people. It's not perfect. I mean, in the end, what we really would like to have, at least I would like to have, is an economy that when it grows for everybody, not just the people at the very top. And I think the way we're going to accomplish that as a country is by investing again in America. We got to invest in our infrastructure. We have to invest in our education system. We have to invest in R&D here. And we just haven't been doing that in the last 30 years. And China you know, is starting to get to a point where they're eclipsing us on those grounds. So to me, not only is that sensible from a policy perspective, it's sensible from a political perspective because you can explain it to anybody.
Right. So why do you think there is a challenge in accomplishing any of those things, where it would seem to be a win for Republicans or for Donald Trump to want to accomplish a lot of things that you discussed, to provide some opportunity and relief for the largest group of voting Americans?
Because we never get to it, because we never get past the political games, which have, you know, in my mind, these press releases around something like Medicare for All, you know, which comes to dominate the debate among the on the Democratic side and set up an opportunity for President Trump to disqualify Democrats instead of pursuing a set of policies that actually are going to make a big difference to the working families of my state or your state or the kids that I used to work for in the Denver Public Schools. That's where we should be focused. And the agenda looks different than the social media agenda. It looks different than the agenda that raises money on Twitter. It looks like an agenda that living, breathing human beings need us to address. And I think when we get to a point where we get some leadership in this country again, we will see Democrats and Republicans work on this. I look forward to being president and going to one of the reddest places I can find in the country and explaining just what I'm doing with the proceeds of reversing the Donald Trump's tax cut. I look forward to the day of being able to say to Republican farmers and ranchers in America, you know what, I'm actually delivering on what Donald Trump promised you rather than the mirage he created to deliver a tax cut to the wealthiest people in our country.
You mentioned the environment of gridlock and individuals elected to Congress kind of retreating to their own ideological corners and playing to the loudest voices. This is a problem that obviously has manifested itself over many, many years, and I think it's going to take many, many years to move back. But how do you begin that process? And how? What is the challenge of a president in being the individual to do that when, in fact, whether it's, you know, Barack Obama and, you know, Mitch McConnell saying we're going to make him a one-term president, or all the investigations into President Trump, it seems like the focus on the president on behalf of Congress and not wanting to work with that individual is something that has precedent and is likely to continue.
I would say first, at the most basic level, we need to reconsider what it means to be a patriot in this country. And when this country was founded, it wasn't founded on the proposition that we would agree with each other. It was founded on the proposition that we would disagree with each other. That's what freedom of speech is all about. Mm-hmm. That's what the freedom to petition the government or freedom of the press is all about. These guys that founded the country didn't think that we were going to somehow have some magic consensus going forward. What they believed was, out of the disagreement, the back and forth, the to and fro, that we would create more imaginative and creative and durable solutions than any king or tyrant could come up with on their own. That's why you still have a 400-person legislature. That's the idea. And so the first thing we've got to do is see how warped our current political system is compared to the way it was imagined to begin with. And then you've got profound structural issues around Citizens United, partisan gerrymandering, the special interests in D.C., many of which are meant to keep things the same. You know, McConnell has perfected the art of creating a constituency to keep stuff the same.
Harry Reid was also pretty good at that.
I'll accept that point.
And Pelosi.
We have to create a constituency for change in the country. And that means putting together unusual coalitions around healthcare, the economy, climate change. I'm not naive about the difficulty of dealing with the Freedom Caucus in Washington. Those guys won't compromise with anybody, and they need to be beaten or overcome. But the way to overcome them in a democracy is with ideas that are powerful enough that we can unite a group of people. For example, dealing with drug prices. Who wants to stand in the way of that? The pharmaceutical industry does. If we had a proposal to take out to the country that said, this is how we're going to do it, and these are the people that are keeping us from doing it, I think you'd succeed. I think if you had a plan to reverse Trump's tax bill and say, this is how we're going to make work pay in this country again, we're going to succeed. And you ought to be clear about who the villains are in this story and who's preventing it from happening. Today, there's no clarity because McConnell does such a good job of obscuring what's going on down there. There's no accountability. And with Trump there, it's like a circus every single day.
Right.
You know? So, which reminds me of one last point, which is, and I think about this in my old school district days, you know, if we just think about what we want to leave our kids and our grandkids, and, you know, all the seniors that you guys represent, what they're thinking about in terms of what they want to leave their kids and their grandkids, that ought to have a very clarifying effect on our willingness to lay down these stupid battles and actually pick up the interest.
So, Senator, again, welcome to New Hampshire.
It's great to be back.
And so speaking of questions that really are important to living, breathing people, living, breathing Granite Staters, and there's quite a few of them here, about 1.3 million. Half a million of them are over 50 years old. So something they're very concerned about is the cost of brand name drugs. So the price of brand name drugs have gone up significantly higher than the rate of inflation, as I'm sure you know. And to contextualize it a bit more, between 2012 and 2017, the annual cost of drug treatment's gone up 57.8%. And then salaries of Granite Staters have gone up some 13.2% during that five-year period. So the question for you is, on behalf of many of those people who really need some relief, is that what's the first thing you'd do in a Bennett presidency to lower drug prices for Americans?
Yeah, it's totally unsustainable. It's unsustainable for the American people who are having to make the decision, many of them seniors, about whether they're going to buy food or fill a prescription. And it's unsustainable for the country. We're spending twice as much on health care as any other industrialized country in the world. And a lot of that is drug price. Not all of it is, but a lot of it is. And the first thing I would do is pass my Medicare X bill, which requires the federal government to negotiate drug prices on behalf of everybody, including seniors. I think that would be a big step forward. If I had a second thing to do, it would be to make sure that patents aren't abused in this country, that drug patents aren't used to game the system, and that we were able to have a more reliable set of generic drugs that people could also buy. So there is no reason why anybody in America should pay more for a name brand drug in this country than they do anywhere else in the world. The best way to get that is through negotiation. And then on the back end of that, I think having a good supply of generics would make a difference too.
Fair enough. And when you talked about people limiting and I think you did, but I will. People, about 22% of Granite Staters in 2017 limited their meds because of cost, so they're self-rationing. Yep. So that being said,
By the way, that just because, as you know, prescriptions aren't meant to work in part. That's why they're prescribed way they are. And so if people can't take their prescriptions, it means they'll get sicker. And if they get sicker, it's just more expensive for everybody in this society, which is another reason we need universal health care in this country.
So if that being said, that you see people doing just what they should not be doing because of the cost of prescription drugs, how would you hold the drug companies accountable? I mean, powerful, very powerful in Washington. Everybody knows it.
Well, we're working. First of all, we some good news. We've got a bill in the Finance Committee right now on which I serve that would penalize drug companies for raising prices higher, you know, faster than inflation. And I think that's really good. It's a good start. But the way to really deal with this is to create a negotiation and then to have penalties on companies that price gouge the American people. There is absolutely, you know, when I think about what provokes people in my town halls to tears, it is their intersection with the American healthcare system. And if we could just cure some of the crazy partisan politics down there, we could fix these problems, including drug prices. And by the way, we need to do more on cost than that, but that's important.
I think one of the Todd, if you have another point.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah. I mean, so do you deal with that when you hold them accountable in addition to sort of championing legislation? Do you ask the DOJ to investigate? Do you take some kind of executive
action?
Sure.
Well, that's a great point too. That's a slightly different point, but it's an excellent point. If you look at the return on invested capital, which is just a fancy way of saying profit, mm-hmm. of our most profitable companies in America over the last 50 years, you look at that line and it's basically essentially flat. Why? Because in a capitalist society, if you start to earn an outsized profit, someone else will come in and compete that profit down. That's the way it's supposed to work. Since 1995, among the most profitable companies in America, that line has gone straight up because nobody can compete the profit down. And those companies are the pharmaceutical companies, and they are the large technology companies. And we do need to use the investigative power of the federal government, DOJ, FTC, and others to make sure we're holding people accountable. So the American fine.
Final question is in regards to affordable housing and also the price of rent, which is a significant issue here in New Hampshire and across the country as well. From a federal perspective, what can be done in regards to affordable housing and also rent costs, which are another significant aspect of what you're describing before with the challenges around middle-class families, particularly the young children?
So I'd say overall, first of all, we should not have a tax. We have, should not have a housing policy that basically subsidizes wealthy people to the detriment of poor people. We shouldn't have that, and we do have that. And you see that, for example, in the fact that you got the mortgage deduction on the one hand, but you don't, but only 20%, if that, of the people that are eligible for housing vouchers in this country get those housing vouchers. In fact, it may be closer to 12%. So I've called for fully funding those housing vouchers, and we got to build more housing. We're 7 million units short of affordable housing in America. I propose that HUD could build half of that, and the rest of it could be done in public-private partnerships. We have to incentivize communities to build that housing close to jobs, close to transportation, and close to where people are, and that's going to require more density, and that's going to be create a challenging argument around the country, but we got to do it, by the way, not just in urban areas, but in rural areas as well, where some of the most challenging environments in America on housing are not urban areas, they're rural areas, and it is very often where seniors are living and not able to access affordable housing.
Yeah, that density conversation is certainly a really important one and has to take place in regards to transportation and all that.
Right, and we got to do it. And somehow what happens in D.C. a lot of the times is the tax benefits that people write into the code surprisingly end up benefiting, you know, Goldman Sachs or somebody like that, instead of communities that are actually trying to do the right thing by creating more density and giving seniors and others the opportunity to be able to live close to where they work or close to their families. This is not an unsolvable problem either.
Senator Bennett, appreciate your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.